This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 8th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 373. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, border security in the wake of Donald Trump's tariff threats to Canada and Mexico. 27 years ago, the Liberal government of the day defunded Canada's ports police. My guest is Peter German, the former head of the RCMP in Western Canada and now the chair of the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute. Peter German says the time is long overdue to bring the police back to the ports to battle fentanyl, guns, and other illegal goods. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Justin Trudeau went for dinner with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago on November 29th, after the president-elect threatened to slap tariffs on Canadian and Mexican goods if the two countries did not get serious about border security. Trump says there's too much fentanyl and too many illegal aliens entering from both countries. Now, Mexico is the bigger problem on both counts, but we can see the results of fentanyl addiction and its related crime in cities and towns from coast to coast in Canada. My guest this week is Peter German, the former RCMP Deputy Commissioner for Western Canada and the North. He is also the former Pacific Region Director for Corrections Canada. You may know the name Peter German better for his dirty money reports for the BC government. Those set the stage for the Cullen Commission public inquiry on money laundering. Peter German is now the chair of the Vancouver Anti-Corruption Institute at the University of BC. In 2023, he wrote Policing Our Ports for the City of Delta, which shines a light on the lack of policing at Canadian ports. Peter, in your report, you go over the history of how we got here. And one key moment in that history was from the 1990s when the Ports Canada Police was disbanded. This is a case study of what happens when a police force is defunded.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. First of all, what a pleasure to be with you again on the podcast. I admire all your investigative reporting. It's great work. The report itself was quite timely, as events have shown. We looked at the history of Ports Canada Police. I was somewhat familiar with it already from my previous background. But essentially, in answer to your question, Canada did have a ports police, a uniform and plainclothes ports police force. It was called the National Harbors Board Police. And when I was just a young rookie police officer, the NHBP existed. And we saw them as the people that looked after the ports. With the evolution of the governance and restructuring of our ports, they became the Ports Canada Police. All of that was disbanded in 1997. The Ports Canada Police no longer existed, and their responsibilities were turned over to municipal police forces of jurisdiction, which in our case would be Vancouver, Delta. In fact, there are about seven municipalities that have ports in the Lower Mainland. And that existed that happened right across the country. There have been no ports police in Canada since 1997, other than municipalities essentially answering calls. The RCMP remains engaged. They're the federal police, of course, in Canada, and they have a responsibility in terms of the drug laws and so forth.
Why couldn't this new model, without ports police, but with municipal police subbing in, going to answer calls, municipal police of jurisdiction, why couldn't this work?
Well, for one thing, every police force operates differently, different policies, different procedures. You also don't have necessarily the expertise. If you take Delta as an example, Delta is a relatively small police department. It's an excellent police department. It practices community policing in the Delta area, and I'm a resident in Delta. We love our Delta police, but they don't have huge expertise in terms of ports. If they respond to calls at Delta Port, which is the largest port, Vancouver, city of sorry, the port of Vancouver, which includes Delta Port, is the largest in Canada. If they if they respond to calls at Roberts Bank at Delta Port, they essentially have to knock on the door, press the button, request admittance, and they then begin whatever investigation it is. So it's really a response to call policing model. That's not adequate. We need something much better than that for our ports.
Now, Delta's Roberts Bank container terminal has roughly 3 million containers going through it every year. That's a lot of containers. Any idea from your research of how many of those containers are actually inspected every year?
Well, the CBSA, Canada Border Services Agency, of course, is responsible for incoming and outgoing cargo and so forth in our country. And, you know, they do a good job considering their resources and their limitations, but they're not terribly forthcoming in terms of what they inspect. And the individuals at the local level were really not allowed to speak to us when we put together our ports report. We spoke with the vice president of CBSA in Ottawa. She was very pleasant, but I can't give you specifics. So it would be really nice to know. The general view is that CBSA only has the capacity to examine a very small percentage of the number of containers. There are millions of containers come in, a very small percentage of those that come into Canada, and an even smaller percentage of those that leave Canada, which is not good. It's not a good situation. And if I could just add to that, the experience with organized crime that emanates from Asia is that a lot of legal or illegal activity is mixed with legal activity. So there is a thing called tailgating, where legal shipments contain an illegal component. So someone will add something to the back of a container. So what is, you know, dominantly a legal contents in a container may also include some packages of drugs, whatever it might be. So, you know, that even that makes the problem even more difficult.
Yeah, you mentioned drugs. Other risks could be weapons. I mean, we've had a lot of stories in the past couple of years, mostly from Eastern Canada, about stolen cars going offshore. What are the most popular types of contraband that go undetected in our ports
Right.
that may be
So
detected by other countries?
commodities, organized crime exists to make money, simple as that. And they will shift from commodity to commodity depending on where the greatest profit is. What we're most familiar with in this country is drugs, but it could include human cargo. It could include environmental cargo, one sort or another. It could involve copyrighted or, you know, intellectual property. It could include animals. You know, the sky's the limit. If you go to different countries in Asia, Africa, their priorities are not necessarily drugs. They can be one of these other commodities. So anything could be coming in, and you know, there's no it's really whatever organized crime wants to move.
Now, Vancouver and other Canadian ports up and down the coast of British Columbia, including Delta, don't have dedicated ports police. We talked about that, but other ports down south do. Can you compare the situation here in British Columbia with Seattle?
Yeah, most certainly. And Bob, before I do that, I don't think I responded totally to your earlier question in that you referenced the issue of stolen cars in Eastern Canada, and I think that's actually quite interesting when you look at it from a Western perspective. The stolen car issue in Canada predominantly occurs in Ontario and Quebec. And as we know, those vehicles tend to go offshore. They're not going to the United States. They're going to Africa predominantly and other countries where they are a hot commodity. Obviously, insurance companies lost a lot of money or are losing a lot of money. And there's a certain, well, definitely victimization citizens when they lose their cars. But out west here, that has not been our main problem. Our problem has been drugs coming into the port. So I think that's important to recognize. In answer to your question, as part of our ports report, we did go to the United States. We talked to a couple of jurisdictions. The United States has different models depending on where you go, but predominantly they include a uniform policing component. So we looked at Seattle, and Seattle has what's called the Port Police. And the Port Police look after two ports. They look after the airport and the seaport. Most of their resources are at the airport, which you can understand, but they also have 24-hour police in uniform at Seattle Port. And they have boats. They're a fully equipped police force. They even do community policing of individuals who live within the port area, let's say on houseboats and so forth. But they are a very long-standing, well-defined police force that knows what moves in the port of Seattle. And they're the first point of contact for the U.S. federal agencies when they have inquiries. So if the FBI has to go to the port with respect to a matter under their jurisdiction or the Drug Enforcement Administration, they deal with the port police, and the port police are part of task forces and so forth. So that is, I would say, probably the preeminent model. And we talked to the port authorities as well as the police. We talked to the FBI, you can't help but come away being impressed by how this works.
To what extent do shipments that come through BC ports, the unpoliced BC ports, to what extent do they get shipped back or shipped across into the United States and end up in other locales? I mean, we've got a long unprotected border, mostly unprotected border with the United States. We've prided ourselves on that for so many years. Of course, that's Trump's concern now. But if contraband comes through Delta Port or Port of Vancouver, what happens next? How often certain types of commodities do end up in criminal hands, in organized crime hands, and then are shipped across into the United States?
Yeah. So in terms of actual, quantifying the amount of drugs and other illegal products that enter the states, that is something I don't think anyone can really do with accuracy. Most reports, most statistics are based on seizures. And we know that seizures tend to be a very small percentage of what actually takes place. No different than, people driving around with drugs in their car. How many cars are stopped compared to how many people have drugs in their car, by way of example. But the way I would look at it is this. If you look at Vancouver's ports, Delta Port, Surrey Port, what you see are containers being offloaded onto one of two things, trucks, trains. And so it's trucks and trains that take containers and transship them somewhere else. Many of them go across the country. They go to different provinces. Some stay here in the Lower Mainland. But we were told that approximately 30% transship into the United States. So in that case, they're either going by rail or by truck through a U.S. border crossing. And then essentially, the U.S. will be inspecting those cargoes. And, some would say that is a second check. However, if we're not checking the cargo, then essentially they're doing the job for us. So one would hope that we're checking a sufficient number of containers. If we're not, one would hope that the American authorities are doing that at the 49th parallel.
Why isn't there a speedier response out of Ottawa to deal with this problem, especially with suggestions that organized crime has infiltrated the ports and are taking advantage of the fact there aren't police there? Why isn't this becoming a big issue, as big an issue as the Eastern Canadian issue of stolen cars, especially when we're seeing, again, on our streets, in our big cities and even small cities across British Columbia, the impacts of contraband that comes through the port, fentanyl, for instance, the fentanyl precursors that come through the port. Why hasn't Ottawa done something?
I think in many ways it's who shouts loudest. So maybe the insurance companies and media and so forth in Eastern Canada are shouting a little bit louder than we have been out here. There's no doubt that politicians have become aware of it. Premier Eby endorsed the need for ports police, as did his public safety minister Farnsworth, previous public safety minister. The BC Union of Municipalities passed a resolution in favor of port police in 2019. They passed another one this past year, I think 2024, at their meeting. So it's not as if people are not aware, but has it reached that same level? Has the noise level reached the same as we saw with cars in Eastern Canada? I would say, however, that it's also not an issue of a particular political party, because if you think about it, with the ports police abolished in 1997, and despite Senate reports, municipalities complaining, etc., we've had both, conservative and liberal governments nationally. We've had various different governments provincially, and the situation hasn't changed. So I don't ascribe this to one particular political party. Now, the other thing I would point out, Bob, is that you mentioned the fact organized crime in the ports. I have to shout out to Kim Boland, who has done amazing work with the Vancouver Sun in terms of what takes place in our ports. Her reporting is next to none on that. But ports traditionally have been a hotbed for organized crime. You can go as far back as you could look at Marlon Brando on the waterfront in the early 50s. That's exactly what they're talking about. They're talking about a different age when you didn't have containers. But, the model has changed, but the issue has continued. And right now, we don't really know who's working in our ports because the police aren't there. Ports are well secured. There's electronic fences. There's private security. There's, the electronic surveillance, but that's to keep people out of the port, and that's not dealing with what's going on inside the port. And another like interesting little fact that only a historian would be interested in, I suppose, is that the first publicly funded police force in the United States was in Boston in 1838, and it was a police force dealing with the ports. And of course, they'd had a tea party there about a century earlier, so they were quite concerned about the ports. So this is not a new issue.
And finally, the dollars and cents question. There's enough sense to have a ports police, but how much would it cost to build? How much would it cost to have a national ports police force at all the major ports across the country, or even just regional here in British Columbia? Is there any ballpark dollar figure? And also within that, would it be difficult to recruit officers?
Yeah, so great questions. Our port policing report is freely available on the City of Delta's website. You just have to plug in port policing City of Delta and you'll come up with it. So really your questions relate to a few things. First of all, what would the model be for policing? We don't recommend a particular model, but what we do say is here are some options. You could go with the status quo, which in my view is nothing really. You could develop a national ports police again, as we had before. You could develop a Greater Vancouver ports police, just dedicated to the Vancouver area, but it would be relatively small. So I don't know if you necessarily want to do that. You could make it part of an existing police force, like the RCMP, could have a uniform component, or you could have something like an integrated, something like a Seattle model, where you've got an integrated transportation police. That's what they have in the United Kingdom. You see the transport police at the railway stations and so forth. We've got a transit police here. Maybe the transit police could also be responsible for reports. So first of all, you got to figure out the structure, and then the cost of that will flow. How do you raise the money? Well, I have to shout out again to Mayor Harvey and to Chief DeBoer from the Del from Delta, in that they suggested different models of funding, but one of them is self-funding by the ports, and their suggestion was essentially taxing containers a few dollars per container, and you've probably got yourself a police force. So that's and then finally your question about recruiting. It is true that recruiting is very difficult for police forces. In this day and age, Surrey is an example of that, where they can't field a full police force at this point in the city of Surrey, despite being police force of jurisdiction. You know, they're essentially, you know, less than half the resources on the road. So where do you find them? The RCMP has had a lot of luck lately in hiring, principally because their salaries are now commensurate with other police departments, and they have lots of opportunities for career development to offer. So I suspect it's one of these cases where you have to create an attractive model and then, you know, aggressively recruit. The people are there. It's a matter of finding the best and bringing them on board and keeping them rather than moving off to some other department.
It's not just an issue that should be talked about nationally in context of tariffs and Donald Trump's threats. It's about the safety of our own citizens here, safety of our own country. Peter German wrote the Policing Our Ports report for the city of Delta, among many other reports in recent years, about how to make British Columbia, how to make Canada a safer place, and how to battle transnational organized crime. Thanks again, Peter, for joining us on the podcast.
You're most welcome, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you to my guest, Peter German, and some postscripts courtesy of his Policing Our Ports report. The Quebec-based Hells Angels expanded to BC in 1983, taking over from the Satan's Angels gang. They did this allegedly to give the Hells Angels a foothold in BC ports. Canada, US, and Mexico ports are tied together on the vast CKPC railway network. In the US, post 9/11, all port employees require a basic security clearance, but in Canada, only 20% of them are vetted.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, UN delegation reiterates support for Taiwan's global participation. Delegation in Taiwan to understand nation's healthcare and defense policies. Delegation leader Palau UN Ambassador Elana Said thanked Taiwan for its long-standing friendship with diplomatic allies and pledged to continue supporting Taiwan on the international stage, including in the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and the International Civil Aviation Organization. In the Korea Times, martial law soldiers sent to buildings of Election Commission, liberal YouTuber. The buildings of the National Assembly were not only the target of martial law troops during the hours that followed President Yoon Suk Yeol's order on December 3rd. According to the National Election Commission, more than 100 troops armed with rifles and other military equipment were sent to its headquarters in Gyeonggi Province. Kim Woo-jun, a YouTube channel operator who is popular among liberals, also said that he, too, was targeted by martial law troops. In ABC News Australia, court slashes Bunbury woman's $1.1 million payout over chicken treat hot chips contaminated with caustic soda. Kerry Pringle suffered serious injuries after being served chips contaminated with caustic soda at Bunbury Chicken Treat in 2013. She was eventually awarded a $1.1 million payout. The Western Australia Court of Appeal reduced Ms. Pringle's payout to a little more than $500,000 after an appeal by the franchisee. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, new data shows Oregon's housing crisis arrived slowly, then all at once. Between 2015 and 2019, Oregon's population grew by 3 residents for every new housing unit, the Oregon Department of Housing and Community Services report says. Oregon has, by its own numbers, the third highest rate of homelessness per capita in the country, trailing only New York and Vermont. Many factors contribute, but two are its high rates of substance abuse and mental illness. In Crosscut, priced out. Fear and resistance in Washington mobile home parks. The Cascade PBS documentary explores how one ownership group has bought up communities statewide and raised rents, straining low-income residents. To increase revenues, park owners can minimize spending on upkeep, hike rents, impose new charges, and shift operating costs to residents. While investors rake in billions, thousands of American families are being priced out of one of the last bastions of affordable housing. When the investors can make more money off the land than the parks that sit on top of it, the parks often go away altogether. And in the Breaker.News, these headlines. Exclusive. Vancouver bureaucrats backtracked on plan for a public meeting about hosting 2026 World Cup. And last night of Surrey RCMP command was very manageable. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to local businesses who support local charities, local schools, and local sports. Spend your Christmas shopping time and money with a small business. December 8th is the end of Local Business Week, but two more weeks remain until Christmas. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 8th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 8th of December in 2013, Metallica performed in Antarctica, becoming the first band to play on all continents, and in 2019, the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in China. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.